the stairs. He spoke of was and when, although I wasn't there. He said I was his friend, which came as some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone a long, long time ago.
I spoke to the guest for like 30 seconds. She was calling, Skyping from her phone, but it sounded a little like noisy. So I asked her, so she said she could switch over to a computer. She's just going to take 2 minutes to switch.
Oh, okay, cool. All right. Well, that gives me time to look up the tarot reading in Mad Men. Are you a Mad Men fan there? Andros, I think I remember.
I've watched the whole series twice.
Yeah, that's so. Why I asked Andros to join us today, because I know he was big into Mad Men as well, and I just thought it would be a good, like, let you guys kind of be able to speak to her more on that level, since I've never seen the show.
Well, I think it's kind of fun that you haven't seen the show and are taking part in this. Like, I showed Joe Alexander the Rosemary's Baby sink night before last, and he had never seen Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, wow.
And that made it so much cooler, actually, the fact that he had never seen it. He didn't have, he was approaching it as such a clean slate, you know. I told him the basic premise, and then he went from there. I was like, basically, everyone's a witch, except for her and one other guy. And, you know, he enjoyed it, but he expressed afterwards that he liked the experience of approaching a film on mute that you've never seen before. It just adds an element of, like, that there's another level of communication happening. I mean, a lot of it feels like sign language sometimes when you're watching a film on mute with music. It's like something's being articulated on another level than you're used to. If you were deaf, you don't, like, watch life first with sound and then start life over. You know. All right, Mad Men Tarot. Do you remember that? I should wait for her.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I here?
Yes.
You're here. Wonderful to have you. Really appreciate all your emails and everything, and I hope I really look forward to doing this today.
Thank you. It's actually kind of terrifying to be here, and it's funny that you mentioned the emails, because I didn't feel like there was an onslaught, maybe one or two or three. And then all of a sudden you asked me to come on, and I said yes, because why, you know, who would say no? But totally terrifying. Hi.
Don't be terrified.
This is a very casual conversation. We just dialogue. So our show, I don't know if you've, you have listened to it. I mean, I that's how you found, you wanted to talk to us about this, so you may have noticed that we're not your standard radio show. So we just are having a conversation and happen to be recording it, you know.
Well, yeah, and that's how I got onto you guys, and I was listening. I've been listening for such a long time, actually. I mean, at least since the summer, and going into back catalogs, and I know it's a casual conversation, and while I'm going about, you know, my daily business, and you guys are talking, and sometimes I, you know, have things to pop in with, or I have to pause it because I want to think for a little while about what was said. And so it shouldn't be as nerve-wracking as it is in this moment. I'm sure once we get rolling, I'm going to forget all about that.
I can relate to that. The first time I went on 42 minutes, I felt very nerve-wracked. And then I got used to it. But yeah, I hear you. Mad Men. You're into Mad Men, or you're interested in the topic of Mad Men.
A little bit. You know, you guys were talking about it at some point this summer, and I think it was you, David, but I somehow misidentified, because that's the other thing, is that when you're the average listener, it's sometimes difficult to identify whose voice with whose backstory and whose name. So I think I had,
That's a great point. Let's sort of do this right now as we're kind of getting started here. So I'm Alan. You've been speaking to David. David, say hi so we get your voice.
Hi.
That's David. I also asked Andros Jones to join us today because he's another big Mad Men fan. So Andros, if you're with us, say hello.
Oh yes, I'm here, ready to talk Mad Men.
And and our guest today is Jen. She's going to go by the name Jen X, and we're really, really happy to have you with us.
I feel like I'm a member of you.
I'm sorry, repeat that?
Well, you're Gen X. I feel like I'm a member of you.
Generation X.
Yes.
Right, which is exactly how I came up. I don't have a book, I don't have a blog, and I had to talk to you guys, and I had to come up with something on the fly. And I'm in the same generation, exactly, Andres. And it's so lame, that's what I came up with.
Oh, no, it's great. I like it.
I like it,
very
too.
Very cool name. And it also, you know, it's also Malcolm X-y, too. So it's a double, it's double X.
Ooh, I love it that way. Thank you. So where do we start?
Well, I have a place I would like to start. I'm curious of which points in particular you were more interested in. The first thing that came to my mind was the fact that every episode of Mad Men ends with a flash of the Sun card. If you follow out to the end of the credits, they'll show you the Rider Sun card. And in front of me, I have a tarot reading that was given to Don Draper. I don't know what season it was, but he receives a tarot reading. And that reading is kind of profound in a way when you look at the overarching themes of the movie and the fact that he gets a reversal of the Sun card as his central card in the reading. Are you familiar with this?
Which episode this was?
I think it's season two. I don't know which episode of season two, but it was one of those. If you go onto the internet and you just type in Mad Men Tarot, you'll get it right away.
Got it.
You can probably look at the reading there, but you could go through card by card, and it's interesting. He has the Major Arcana of the Sun, like I said, in the center. Above it, he has a Judgment card, which I don't know if that's supposed to be Gabriel with the trumpet, but it's a very Kabbalistic idea of the three risen figures in the coffins. So the dead will rise from the grave that has to do with the dew of mana and all of this. It's a lot to get into. Below that, he's got the Page of Pentacles. The pages represent when you've gone through the smaller cycles enough times and you've reached to a place of dignity. Or you have kind of an overstance of things, right? So you've reached a place of perspective. So he's there holding the discs. The disc is the most dense because the suits in tarot represent different sheaths of the four worlds. So the discs are the most dense side of the spectrum. You have what's carrying him through his experience. If I look at it, looks like I'm not as familiar with the Rider deck as I am the Thoth deck, but I think it's eight or nine. I know it's eight or nine of cups, and that it's Pisces. So I think it's like Moon in Pisces or something, and it's moving on from something that no longer really serves. It has to do with emotion. Got the Three of Cups is his past moving through. I hope it's okay that I'm just going through this because I'm just, you know, I find it interesting. Basically, Three of Cups, which would be abundance in tarot's in Crowley's tarot deck, is what is that? He relates that to like Persephone in the underworld, and basically starting the cycle of winter. So basically, taking pleasure in something, and then pleasure generates cycles. Anything you desire multiplies itself. So it's the multiplication of desires. So for that, for Don Draper's past is kind of interesting. Is it the Five of Swords, which would be defeat in Crowley's deck, is his future. So you have this defeat, like you see at the beginning of every episode, is he's falling from this large building, which I relate to as Babel, the collapsing of his tower, which is also his phallus, right? His whole life is basically a phallus. The column going up to the side, the Celtic cross.
Or a fallacy.
Yeah, because his whole life is a fallacy, right? In his bring to, he has the world. And I'm trying to remember where that comes up later in the show. That's very significant. And she emphasizes that in the episode. She picks up that card. And she's telling him the significance of that. Yeah, I think it is the Eight of Cups, Alan. And you know that woman is supposed to be not. I mean, people relate to like the universe or the world card as a woman, but really it's supposed to be androgynous. It is Malkuth, and so what's being represented is literally the genitals, and the fact that she picks up that card and tells him the significance of it, not to be too redundant, is very significant. So above that, so that's what you'd say is your bring to. These also relate to, like, people will say physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual in terms of the line going up. So they also relate to the physical as your bring to. Second is your environment and your emotional connection to your environment. There he has the nine okay, let me see here.
It's Eight of Wands is above the Wheel of Fortune, and it's nine that is below.
Okay, right.
I just pulled out a Rider deck to just kind of verify which was which, because it's kind of hard to see in these screenshots. But if you're looking at Wheel of Fortune, what is above it is the eight, and what's below it is the nine.
So eight would be Valor, I think, in Crowley's deck. Which is like, if the way that he would relate to it, as I recall in the Book of Thoth, he'd be like, if you're in a platoon and you're at war and your group leaves, your platoon leaves you, and you're there to fend for yourself. So you're all alone, or maybe that's the fucking seven. I don't know. Or no, this is also Sagittarius. I don't know. I need to look it up. I'm so bad with the Rider deck. I apologize.
Okay, David, can I stop you here? Because I have a question, actually. You were, I lost you for a second. You were talking about the opening. You were talking about a tarot card and the opening sequence with the, you know, Don falling, which that pose with the one leg bent and the one leg up in the air, also reminds me of that iconic, awful photograph from 9/11. I think it was in the Times. Do you remember that?
Sure, the falling man, they call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a painting by an artist whose name I can't remember. He does kind of esoteric work. And, you know, so that image comes up on tarot cards. It comes up, you know, in that 9/11 ritual. It comes up all the time. And could you espouse on that for me? Which card were you talking about originally?
Well, I mean, there's the world card, and it's a very similar pose, except she's right side up like you'd see in the Hanged Man. And the Falling Man in 9/11, I don't think I would be the first to relate that to the Hanged Man. Am I right in that, Alan?
Oh, no, absolutely, yeah. I want to just kind of point out real quick, for whatever it's worth, we're talking specifically about that pose where the legs are kind of crossed. Let's say we take the Rider World card and you see her leg is bent. Again, I haven't seen the show Mad Men, but does the image you're talking about, he's in that same bent leg position? Jen, that's what you're saying? His leg is bent the same way?
Yeah, I mean, he's falling, so he's falling, and I think it gestures that way. I haven't seen the opening credits since the last season ended, I think there's a moment where he's maybe in that position or gets close to it.
So
either way, you can't see him. You can't see a body falling in front of a building and not think of that photograph.
Absolutely right. I just want to point out that particular leg pose appears in three different cards. There's the World card, there's the Hanged Man card, and there's also the Emperor. Now, the Emperor is a mirrored version of it. So he has what I guess would be his right leg crossed over his left leg, and the Hanged Man has the left leg crossed over the right, and so on. So what if you kind of take those cards, you have the Emperor, then the Emperor hangs. It's your king kill, right? So the Emperor switches sides. The Hangman is actually putting him upside down, but it's also mirroring him. It's reversing him. And then when it becomes the World card, it stays in that same position as it was on the Hanged Man, if that makes sense. Those three cards share that same sort of sequence through the leg positions.
Point of it is the triangles. I've heard that from multiple places, where when he's got his leg crossed like that, you're looking at a triangle facing one way. If you look at the Hanged Man card in the Rider deck, you'll see the way that the arms are behind. I think it's even in the Crowley deck too. You'll see that you have two triangles facing each other in opposite directions, and they represent spirit and matter, Purusha and Prakriti in the sutras, but it's a separation or the uniting of the two. In the World card, the way she has her arms open, it's supposed to be the triangle that's facing upward that she's representing with her leg is spirit, and her arms being open and her being right side up is the idea that matter is making way for spirit. So, and she holds the phalluses in her hand. So, like, basically our own will is being put aside so that spirit can enter, is the idea. So, just really quickly, in Hopes and Fears, or the intellect above what I think you're saying is the nine of wands, which is strength in Sagittarius, moon in Sagittarius, maybe, you have the Wheel of Fortune, which is very significant, right? I'll just leave it at that. I won't go too transcendental. I'm already doing that. So the outcome of it is, you're saying, the Eight of Wands, which if you look at all the small cards in the Rider deck, it's the only card that does not have a human figure present. It doesn't have any figure present. All it is the wands, and it's swiftness. And I believe it's, if I recall correctly, it's Mercury in Sagittarius. So you have Mercury rules Gemini, so it's its opposite. So there's a positive correspondence there. But that there's no identity was the way I've had it explained to me. There's no form. It's a formless outcome. And it would appear that it's, you know, it's the outcome of his reading, and you might think it's less significant because it's not a major arcana, but it's extremely significant because it's his own disappearance and willingness to be adaptive. Because Mercury takes the form of whatever container, right? It spreads out.
So I want to, again, I'm just looking at this screenshot here. If everyone's looking at the same screenshot, I think it's interesting that to the right of this tarot spread, you have this glass with a ship on it. So it looks, it's positioned actually very well. The ship is in that water, in that drink, right? Do you see that? The ship on the glass is actually like sailing through the drink. And I don't know, is that alcohol or iced tea? I haven't seen the show, but I think that's really an interesting visual there. Then you have what appears to be the number 88 on that piece of paper, and then an ashtray. So I feel like you have, with the ashtray, the ship, and the drink, you kind of have your elements represented there. You know, your earth, your fire, your water, like these are sort of all represented there, the sails blowing in the wind. You have your wind, your water, your earth, your fire, all represented in those elements there. And then that number 88, even though I tend to always steer 88 as a serious thing, it's definitely mercurial. This is something, what is it, I think the planet Mercury takes 88 days to orbit the sun or something like that. The number 88 is usually typically associated with Mercury. So when you're mentioning this idea of him, this mercurial idea of at the top there, I just want to point out that basically, you have those four elements, and the mercurial number would sort of be the magician at his table, and they're literally sitting at the table with these four elements on it.
I'd also like to jump in here and give a little context. The person giving the reading is Anna Draper, who is, for people who know the show, she is the wife of the man who Don Draper stole his name from. And they become friends, and she is kind of like this friendly ghost character in the show. I don't know how much we are honoring spoilers here, but I have a feeling we're going to end up, if you're worried about having the show spoiled for you, you probably shouldn't be listening. Yeah. And what's interesting is that her name is Melinda Page Hamilton. And doing a little research, so we have the page there, but doing a little research here on her, she plays, what's the film that jumps out to me that's interesting for her is that she played one of the main characters in God Bless America, the Bobcat Goldthwait film that sort of, that came out right before the all of these school shootings and movie theater shootings. And is about a guy who goes on this shooting rampage and Page. It's a really ugly film, but probably accurate. You know, it was onto something. But she plays the ex-wife who gets custody of Bill Murray's brother, who plays the lead in that film. And so just. Giving that context, I don't know if that'll can inform our conversation or not.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, Andres, that you point out that she's like the friendly ghost character, because I've had opportunity to be around a lot of kids lately, and I notice in their cartoons there's always this weird little character that doesn't make sense. It's it's a creature in a what's it called? Bob the Builder. There's a scarecrow with a pumpkin head, and he's friendly with all the other, you know, machines that move and Bob the Builder and whatever, and he belongs to Farmer Pickle. But you look at it and you're like, it's a kid's cartoon, and why is this bizarre looking creature in there? And it's just always kind of, I noticed in a lot of cartoons lately, it's just like this thing that slipped in, and I wondered what that represented.
Reminds me of Jack of Oz and the Scarecrow combined or something.
Right. And not just, and like in that particular show, it's a scarecrow with a pumpkin head, but you know, sometimes, like I said, it's a lizard, it's a dragon, but it's, you know, a dragon that's an amalgamation of maybe like two or three different animals. It's always something really kind of off. There's just one thing that's one character who's just a little off.
I mean,
just call it Bob the Freemason. Sorry.
What about the idea that you, I agree, Jen, that there is this very common idea, and whether this is intentional or not, it sort of reminds me of like The Shining, right, where you have Danny, and then he has, Tony, the little, his sort of quote-unquote imaginary friend, or this other thing that you're able to sort of use to speak through. I've never seen Bob the Builder, but
I don't know if I should tell you guys this, but,
yeah.
So... as we started talking about this, there's this little house, there's a little toy house that belongs to my son. And this morning before my husband and he left, he was running around the house on his big wheels like Danny, and I totally had a moment of that. We started talking and it's electric. The stupid song started playing on the house. It just like went off by itself. Good
what
job,
is the,
guys.
What is the song?
It's just the ABC song, but the house has it has little electric things that when you move doors and things, lights go on, and the toy turned itself on. I'm gonna go turn that off. You guys, just give me a second.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the hotel shines. You know, sometimes buildings shine. So I just wanted to throw out the idea of this. You hit on something that I've been kind of thinking of a lot. I found myself really thinking about the old comic strip Family Circus or Family Circle. Do you guys remember that in the newspapers?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And there was the fact that it's a circle, I don't know, I couldn't help but think of it as being a magic circle. And there is a there used to be a character in it called Not Me. And they used, I mean, it was a really cheesy cartoon, and they would do things like, you know, the parents would come home and say, "Who broke this vase?" And the kids would all go, "Not me, not me." And you'd see this little ghost in the corner whose name was Not Me, who did it. And, you know, it was this idea that, like, again, it's like this sort of imaginary or poltergeist type thing. Was it just a joke, or is it whatever? And I couldn't help but think of the idea of the, again, this Crowleyan idea of Nemo, you know, no man, this idea of the thing that is you but isn't you. It's not me.
Yeah. And even, well, that's very applicable.
Yeah, when you're talking about this scarecrow figure, what do they call, like, a straw man argument is a common thing, right? Where you say, like, you if someone's arguing a point, you're having a debate, and you say, well, your side thinks blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, I didn't actually say that. You're creating, it's what they call a straw man argument. So right. I keep thinking this idea of, like, this thing that's you that isn't really you, and this could, we could take this to the realm of, like, the daemon, the higher self, or however you want to think of this. I just wonder, Jen, if that speaks to what you're kind of picking up on or not.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when you talk about, yeah, consciousness, and then you have a kid and you start looking about, you know, your own life, how you got onto things, and then you're looking at things through their eyes and what's going, yeah, absolutely. You just, it's funny, these things come up over and over again, and you start to notice them. There's a little, really, because I don't remember, I remember Family Circus, actually, from when I was a kid. I remember not reading it. There's a little guy always in the, oh, there he is. You're right, on the Wikipedia. There's a little guy who's not drawn in like everybody else is. There you go.
Yeah, he's not making it up.
No, I didn't think he was.
I like the idea of Don Draper being like the, being a ghost in a sense, being that he's taking on the identity of a dead man, and just what that means for him energetically. And there's a very like a purgatory type, thing going on where it's like, he's trying to reach, some point that he can never reach. Like, it's,
well,
this.
And was it on one of your shows that, I just learned this recently, I didn't know, probably it was you, David, who said it, that purgatory isn't meant to last forever. Yeah, it was you. Purgatory isn't meant to last forever. But I know growing up, when you learning whatever your religion is, usually, yeah, purgatory is, it's this place that, well, you go because you have to, yeah, go on.
I was saying in, I believe I was probably referring to hell. And the idea of hell,
right.
Like, and it, I mean, the word that gets used in relationship to it, I forget, what it actually is in Hebrew, but it's the word for straightening a blade. And so it's always been looked at in Judaism as a refinement place. It's whatever doesn't fit, whatever isn't integrated, gets, you know, burnt up in the process, so that only the pure thing is left. And so, but you'll see that in Judaism, there's no eternal hell in the Bible. I mean, it's only mentioned like once or twice or something. But then even in the Apocrypha, you know, when they approach Jesus about looking down on all the people in hell, he like assures them that they won't be there forever, which is interesting. I mean, that didn't end up in the canon, obviously, but it's obvious as to why, because it's not a punishment. It was never looked at as punishment. People put that on it. It was just the way things are. And I relate to Mad Men as it's communicating that same idea. It doesn't relate to things in terms of karma. It relates to things as cause and effect. Karma in terms of the way that, you know, Westerners often look at it as punishment. It's just what it is.
I mean, isn't Don punishes himself?
He does. It's not. Yeah, it's his own. You can see the neuroses. It's not the universe. The universe has an intelligence, which is what this woman is communicating to him here in this reading. That there's an order underlying it. His relationship to that is something else. And so, as far as I can tell, he represents Babel, kind of like something that's working against the grain, thinking that it's going down, it thinks it's going up. And yet, it's going down is going to, you know, allow for a shift to happen. So even going in the opposite direction, if you go far enough, will bring you back, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah. There's on Netflix, it's really great. It's only a half an hour. There's a cartoon I have to watch over and over again called Animal Train. And there's a dog who, again, is that character that's sort of off, that one thing that's kind of off. And he says to the little boy, they're on an imaginary train going on, and the little boy's missing his parents. And the dog says, well, it's okay, the world is round, and, you know, if we continue on the track, if you want to go back, we can go back, but if you continue on the track, you're going to end up at home anyway.
Yeah.
So, but it's funny that you started with the tarot reading, and you started with Anna Draper, because I'd forgotten about her almost entirely when Alan first emailed me about coming on and talking. And one of the things that I had been kind of noodling was that it's funny to me how I feel like all the female characters on the show, they go through changes, they evolve, they learn things, and all the men I see, you know, kind of do that looping thing where they just kind of keep going in the same circles ultimately, and they don't really seem to have any sort of evolution. I don't know if that's just me seeing that or anybody.
No, I agree. They're like chasing their own dicks. They're like trying to find some end to a place where there's no end, and the women seem to recognize the futility more than they do.
When you said that, it made me think of the John Slattery character, and when he takes acid and he has this big awakening, and then it just goes away. Like, he has a couple of episodes where you think maybe he's going to wake up, and then he's back drinking his gin and being like, eh, you know, it was fun.
Yeah.
And like that is, I think you're right about that. Is that why we like the show, or that's what's frustrating about it? It's very interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, as somebody who, like, I mean, I worked in television a long time ago, and I have a love-hate relationship with programming and shows and movies and all that. And it's frustrating for me when I see just, like, the anti-hero, the bad guys constantly lifted up on high, and that's who we're supposed to be rooting for, and I don't really get it, you know. And I'm limping through this last season of Mad Men. I'm gonna go to the end, but it's gonna be hard.
You know, in the center of this reading, you can see the sun is in reverse. The sun is at the end of every episode where you have the conquering child, right? But the card that's covering it, whatever that is, I know it's Pisces. You have that moon on there in the same way that it is in the moon card, which is literally, I mean, that card, though they say it's carrying you through an experience, it's also veiling what's underlying it.
Just for the record, I looked, it is the Eight of Cups. You said whatever that card is, it is the Eight of Cups.
Yeah.
I guarantee
and
you.
So, his name is Don Draper. I mean, as soon as I started watching the show, immediately, I mean, Don Draper, Golden Dawn, draping the dawn. There's a dawn occurring. This takes place in the 60s, and it's being veiled with this kind of Bernaysian kind of approach or whatever, but veiling.
Ooh, something. I just got a little chill.
Yeah, I felt that when I look at this reading, I see a lampshade. Like, I see the moon eclipsing the sun or something. And that's like, that's in the center of his whole deal. And the judgment on top, meaning that something's overseeing it, that is setting things the way that it's supposed to be. The way, I could not believe it. And my girlfriend, you know, we watched them all together. And she knows my obsession with Rosemary's Baby for synchronistic reasons having to do with John Lennon and all this, everything. And you know, when you're approaching the end of the last season, they go out to see Rosemary's Baby. They're trying to work on an ad to communicate the conspiracy in Rosemary's Baby. And I'm like, I'm watching this thing. I'm like, this whole show is like the fucking conspiracy in Rosemary's Baby. And then I'm going through this and, you know, Amy knows my whole thing because she knows my insanity or whatever because, you know, I'm studying Kabbalah and all this stuff. I'm talking about golems. And then here in that season, right around that same period, you know, what's his name? It's been a while. The guy who takes acid. What's his name in the show? Older guy.
Cooper. Sterling Cooper.
Sterling Cooper. Sterling Cooper takes his son to see Planet of the Apes, which we know the connection with 2001: A Space Odyssey and all of that. And the mom is very upset that he took the child to see Planet of the Apes. And his response is, well, when I was a kid, my parents took me to go see the Gollum. How fucking random is that? Rosemary's Baby is about a Gollum, like creating this, like, kind of, you know, this being through other means other than, you know, it's like this reversal, a clefotic version of the virgin birth or whatever. And I'm like,
Go
right ahead.
When I was a kid, I found two different books, like paperbacks, fiction, and one of them that kind of, you know, one was science fiction, and the other one was a book called Gollum, about a Gollum. Even though I grew up on Long Island in kind of a Jewish neighborhood, I didn't know what that was until I read this book that was totally inappropriate and I should never have read. So,
Never have read it.
Oh, say that again?
Why should you have never have read it? Is that what you said?
Oh, my parents wouldn't have picked it for me. You know, right. It was a horror story, and yeah.
Not ultimately what you should never have read, just what you would, you know, what a child should be looking at in the consensus view of.
Right, which kind of reminds me that no matter how much I try to filter it, it's going to get through anyway.
Right. Which is Don Draper's whole trip, you know. He's trying to block and he's trying to restrict and he's trying to direct everything towards some end, and yet the insights come about anyway. You know, it's no matter how hard he struggles against it, this is what happens.
But how do you take that in the realm of an advertising agency? I mean, Jen, you were talking about like movie making stuff where you're putting the anti-hero up. It's sort of like through a glass darkly, right? It's like whenever we're looking at a lot of these things through media, we're getting the kind of reversal. You're talking about Don Draper is unable to avoid the insights coming through, but what he's trying to do is put out the sort of flip side version, right? If you're an advertising agent, you want to steer people towards a specific false insight. Oh my God, I totally need to buy that Swiffer. You know, like you're trying to create insights or steer people towards the false ones. What do you think of that? That it's sort of, when you talk about this idea of the men being stuck in a cycle by him trying to put out the false insight, yet he's unable to stop receiving the true insights. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to blow this out too big, but let's go for it. So the two things that, you know, when you start talking about advertising, the two things that come to mind, one is Bill Hicks saying, if you're in advertising, kill yourself now. Yeah. And and the other one just flew out of my head, so obviously it wasn't important. When you talk about the men, you know, and to me, we're talking about, and I'm not really very personally into this, but, you know, we're talking about gender and so you guys, you know, said, I got an email saying come speak, and I didn't even know what we were going to talk about, and I didn't know we were going to really focus on Mad Men. I feel a little unprepared, actually, and the only thing I could think of was that at some point during the summer, I was listening to your podcast, and a couple of times you guys had said, you know, it's funny, we don't talk to more women in sync, and what's that about? And at the time I thought, yeah, Jen, why aren't you doing anything? But then also, you know, all I could think about was, well, it didn't take me very long when I was young to figure out that the words witch and bitch are pretty much the same word. And from there's just the sort of damping down of, you know, we don't want to hear from you. We don't want to hear what's coming, you know, what you might bring to the table. It's this control thing. And that's also a big story that's going on in Mad Men. And it's the part that I find compelling and why I keep watching it. And advertising is an interesting foil for that, because advertising is about further directing people's, you know, thoughts and desires in that Bernaysian way. So
And it certainly changes the way we look at women as well. Advertising, that's, women are totally the tool that are used to sell anything. So I didn't mean to spring this on you, this idea of Mad Men, because when you had emailed about wanting to speak to David about the tarot idea in Mad Men, I thought that might be a good way to go. But what, since you brought up this idea of women in sync, let's kind of go there.
Can I just ask a quick, because it ties into what you're asking, and it goes in with Mad Men, and it's something I'm curious about Mad Men and shows like it. It seems like in the last few years there have been a lot of shows that are like Mad Men, in, or maybe like The Tudors, films or TV shows that explore this time pre-sexual revolution, and that there's this really interesting thing in which it's like a horror. It is kind of like a horror story aimed at women. A lot of these shows seem to be particularly driving towards a women's audience, and I find it as like in this interesting kind of, when I look at it, that in one way it's this nightmare of this time, but it's always portrayed like everyone, all the women in it are, even though they're struggling with the social aspects, all of the fashion aspects, the fantasy aspect of fashion is played up in a big way. And I've found it intriguing, this phenomenon of these shows like Masters of Sex that are, sort of part nightmare and part fantasy. And I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in there because maybe this relates, or I'll help you kind of tease out where you're going. One of my female roommates, I didn't have many, but I haven't lived with a lot of people, but way back before, you know, I got married, whatever. She's a little bit older than me, and we were talking about, this period of time, and she said, she's like, don't you know that all of that 50s sort of, you know, dress this way, act this way, be the perfect housewife, whatever, was all code for how to deal with your post-traumatic stress disorder husband or spouse or whatever coming home from the war and getting drunk and beating the shit out of you, and how to not have that happen.
Yeah.
And I did not. So there, that's just a little bit of, there.
Huh. Yeah.
I get that. And I guess this is I'm intrigued. You were saying you're limping through the last season of Mad Men. You say you're going to get to it, but you're sort of, what is it that's struggle there?
It's for me, it's, you know, it's Dexter started off really good. I stopped watching before the season where his girlfriend got murdered. Californication, I was so in. I was all in both feet. And then I was just like, no, actually, I'm out. It's just the over and over again, you know, these men usually, but you know, yeah, the anti-hero, like these negative people that we're supposed to be, I don't know, emulating. I think I don't, I'm done. I'm out. That's
right. what about like in, when you say Californication, I always think of Californication and Weeds as being sort of.
Yeah. Weeds. I also did not watch the last season. I was out there too. I mean, every time it just seems to go, it's too many steps too far. And I wake up out of my suspension of disbelief where I'm really enjoying the story. And I go, you know what? Why am I watching a show about characters of people I would never want to even know in real life? Why am I doing that? Maybe I should back away. And one of the reasons I got really into your podcast, your family of podcasts, is that you're all very, nice people. And that comes across. And you're not snarky and you're not mean. And it makes a real big difference for me in terms of like what content I'm going to consume, especially in this world with the internet and, you know, everything's so blown out. You have so many choices. There's really no reason for me to limit myself to, you know, things that make me feel bad about myself and others.
Yeah, I hear you. My girlfriend felt a very similar way about Mad Men when we first started watching it, and she voiced it and I related, and we did not think we were going to get into the show. We thought we were going to watch a couple episodes and then be like, you know, but people kept recommending it to me because of the Sharon Tate thing. I kept on getting messages from people. Steve Wildner was pointing it out to me, and I'm like, well, this is the subject, and then it's like the last season and I haven't started it yet that all that stuff happens. And I'm like, well, I won't know what it is unless if I go there. And me.
Oh, you're gonna really, really like that season. You're gonna love it, and I think that it's. Hope it's okay to jump in. I think that it said that, that I was wondering, you know, yesterday or 2 days ago, I was wondering if, because that season focuses, what year is it, Alan? You're always up on this. Or is it?
It's 68.
Thank you, Andres. Yeah, so, you know, is that, because there's so much going on socially for everybody, is, you know, and we were talking about Generation X, even though we're a little older than maybe some of the youngins in their 20s, I feel like we're all in the same, you know, set of that, you know, 9/11 happened for us, and it changed our consciousness, and it changed what we were looking at, and then, you know, the late 60s and the Vietnam War and the, you know, mid-60s, like, the King Kills, and, yeah, changing, that was their, I don't know, lifting of the veil or whatever, and this is ours, and here we are talking about it.
Well, this is magic. For sure. The way that this show is concocted is very intentional in that you're watching it in real time. It's not a mistake that they're doing it in real time, and that when you start another season, that much time has actually gone by that the show is supposed to be portraying. So you're literally, in the course of the show happening, you're starting again in the early 60s. It starts in the late 50s. The start in, I can't remember when the first episode was.
I think it starts in 1959. They're in the first season, they're trying to get the account for Nixon's camp.
Yes.
1960 campaign for the presidency.
Right. And so the fact that they're doing that, they're like, boom, now you're back here. And we're walking through. And the things that they pick out that are of significance, other than the obvious, like if you have, you know, John F. Kennedy dies or something, but like it all feels very intentional in what they're choosing to emphasize, because there's other things to emphasize during those periods. And so, you know, when they're going off about Rosemary's Baby in the way that they do, that doesn't feel like a mistake to me. They're actually trying to communicate a subtext of that period that some people were paying attention to and some people weren't. Most people were not, because in this like kind of Bernaysian world, there's the real story and then there's what's given to the people. And that's the whole point of the show. On top of the fact that there's this very overt, I'm talking about esoteric, but it gets even more esoteric than just the obvious. Because if someone is watching like the BBC show about Bernays, what was that called? I can't remember.
Century
of the Self.
Right. That gives a certain level of it, but there's an occult side to this as well, that all these people are, not all these people, but a lot of these people are dabbling in, and more than dabbling. And it seems like they're trying to communicate that, as far as I can tell. Thank you.
All right, so here's a question. So we have, Andres brought up the point of the sort of this nightmare fantasy of a lot of these shows, that if it's aimed towards women and saying, here's a time when you were oppressed, but look how good you can look while doing it, right? Like, you know, or something like that. And Jen, you make a really interesting point about, you know, was this a sort of a shield, a way to kind of protect yourself? Like, well, you better look good and do what he says to kind of protect yourself from that. And then we have this weird fantasy aspect. David, you mentioned Rosemary's Baby. I can't help but think of, when we talk the nightmare and the fantasy, this idea of, in Rosemary's Baby, during this horrific rape scene where she says, this is no dream, this is really happening. And yep. I think what we sort of need to focus on is, like, we can talk about the artistic signifiers and say this is all the things that it's representing or that it's speaking to, but it's not just a fantasy, it's not just a TV show. This is really happening. And I thought we could kind of maybe just, at least we don't have to necessarily turn completely away from Mad Men, but shift gears a little bit in the sense that we have, the show is called Mad Men, right? Now, I spoke to a woman who used to work for a podcast show called Sky Blue Symposia. A woman named Susan, very informed woman, and she was saying she listened to some of the shows that we've done recently on SyncBook Radio, and specifically she mentioned Jason Barrera on 42 Minutes. And here he's talking about how all these female musicians are playing out the dark feminine archetype, your Persephones, your Hecates, your, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All these sort of dark female archetypes are being played out. And she said, I thought it was interesting that they didn't ask him and he didn't answer. Why are they doing this? Why do women feel the need to play this out? And she said, and I was like, well, you know, that's a really awesome point. I said, I also don't know if it's something that Jason could have answered, not being a woman. You know, it's the idea that basically what she's saying is no one's asking the question, why is the sacred feminine pissed off? So, Jen, I want to ask you, if that speaks to you at all, we have the idea of mad men. What about the mad woman? Where is that at right now?
Well, as I look at David's icon, you know, his little avatar, I'm gonna steer clear of that. It is going on in the news right now. It's a picture of Mary. Yes, David.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, what's that? Who? What did you say?
When Alan, you know, mentioned the mad woman.
Right.
And I think he was talking. There's a story going on in the news right now, and I'm trying to distract myself from it. Because it was actually back in the 90s, was one of the first scandals that I worked on when I worked in, you know, tabloid TV. We were talking, and I was really overwhelmed. And I'm like, who's this little boy looking at me from MK Ultrasounds, you know? Avatar. And then I was like, oh, and then, you know, it hit me who it was. And I was like, oh yeah. And I'm like, don't pick it up, Jen. Don't pick it up. I think it's such a catch 22 to start talking about that. And it goes back to, you know, witch and bitch, you know, on the one hand you've got, I don't know how, you can only talk about your own experience. I can only talk about myself. I'd never think about, although we're trying to get there, I can't talk for every woman ever, you know. But in my own life, I know that I have feelings about things, knowings, intuitions, you know, it's just like a, and pretty much from the get-go, everyone's trying to tell you not to pay attention to any of those things. And certainly, I see people expressing in ways that make me feel uncomfortable, and I don't want to join in with them, so I end up just doing my own thing. And there's something really powerful there about, and it's really about humanity, because, you know, I can blow that out further and be like, you know, the 1% or the 99%, you know, where we keep getting shunted away from our humanity. I don't think that we need to say, you know, for example, pray to things outside of ourselves. I think that if, you know, that's what that whole going inside and meditating thing is about. There's something about the more, and I think women in that sense may be more powerful than men. And that's why it's really important for them not to be in touch with their inner voice. Because if we start speaking, you know, then we keep, the whole matrix of control, you know, we could just pull a card and the whole thing will fall down.
Yeah, exactly. This is a much larger, I mean, I'll say things and there's a much larger context to them, and I don't always know where to start or how to communicate that. But, like, you know, talking about Kabbalah at all, you know, I'm relating a lot of Kabbalah to this programming, you know, and it's at the heart of the core of everything is the feminine, and that's the whole point, and that's what everything comes down to. And if you read the Tikkuni Zohar or all the commentary that extends out of that, it's all about the female and the exile of the female, of the feminine principle in the world, and that in order for us to build our tower and our society, there's an aspect of the feminine that can't be at the head of that temple. Because if she's put it that if she can be, ultimately, if it was to be in harmony with the universe and actually be something that could endure. But this is the meaning of that the temple won't be built by human hands, is that the receptive principle is not something that stands out in space. It's the envelope of what we're relating to, which is so much more infinitely vast than the little speck that we're looking at as everything. And that we have to, in order to build the type of thing that we're building, it requires us to literally have blinders to what we're repressing. And you'll see this if you look at 16th century Kabbalah from Spain, which is the, you know, the hub of Kabbalah during the 15th, 16th century, you know, that they're all talking about that. And it's funny that that is not what gets emphasized for people when you go on the internet and there's videos and things talking about black magic and this and that and Kabbalah. It's like, no, the purpose that the rabbis were attempting to do, which there's no secret here if you actually read the text, is to liberate the sacred feminine and to put her back in her rightful place on the tree of life and make the tree back into the star and create an equilibrium. It's not to suppress it and allow in the Klipo to take over the tree, outside forces, you know. Like, that's the essence of Kabbalah, is to reunite this split Adam, you know, that the man is divided against himself, and that to end that conflict is to acknowledge, not just acknowledge, but allow that principle to become the head of the temple again. And so I look at the show and I see nothing but what it's communicating is the aversion to that reconciliation, and that his falling is that no matter how hard he struggles against it, the world that is to come will come. Does that make any sense?
Totally.
I'm curious of your thoughts on that, Jen.
I'm processing.
Yeah.
I'm totally processing because I was really with you, and then I got lost for a second because you said something that I didn't understand. Because I got lost in my own thought while you were, I was trying to follow two at the same time. And
perfectly understandable.
That happens here all the time.
Oh, good. Okay. So then there's dualism, you know, is terrestrial, I suppose. Like this male, female, black, white, yin, yang, whatever. It, you know, there's like that discussion going on, and now we talk about transgender and we talk about like, you know, where it's both at the same time. I don't know how to, right? And then you look at how big the universe is and how small we are, and not to get too, I don't know, loopy and out there, but
that's what we do here.
Yeah. I mean, there is when you talk about putting the, at first you said putting the sacred feminine back at the front of the top of the tree of life. And no, at first you said not doing that. And well, then you said doing that. And that's where I got lost.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is that, you know, our, not just our culture in America, but across the world, that in order for empires, as they exist, in the way that they exist, in order to, keep themselves up, they have to take the most sacred thing. And this is the idea of the stone that the builders rejected. The stone that the builders rejected is the Shekinah, which is the receptive principle in matter. And so, it's the womb of space. And so we can't acknowledge the womb of space. Like, if we want this thing to exist as it does, and if we were to let that back in, what we would be existing within would be a vastly different type of reality. That literally our perceptions are changed by how we're building what we're building. It's a It's a weird thing to get into, but this is
I'm totally with you there. Yeah, if you start looking at the really, really, really big picture, it's really hard to keep on a track of violence and oppression, I think.
Right, because they have a substitute feminine, which is, in Christianity, they call it the horror of Babylon. In Judaism, it's the evil handmaiden, but she's essentially not, she's a type of intelligence, but she's not the thing. She's not the Shekinah. She's a substitute reality. And so what the advertising industry and a number of other things, because we're doing it even beyond that, what we're projecting is the substitute female that isn't the actual female. And so we're basically projecting it, and it's a form of magic in order to manipulate ourselves so that we don't have to basically let God back in, you know. Which this is the thing, is that Tetragrammaton, Yod Heh Vav Heh, right? The final Heh of that is a composite of the other three letters, which include the male. Right, so the basis for the male is the female. John Sousa just sent me a question in a message where he was asking about how in the earliest development, you know, we start out as female. Everyone starts out as female, and then they either become a male or a female. And that, you know, and this is like something that you see communicated in Jewish mysticism, not just communicated, but it's at like the center of their whole, you call it a belief system, but like their understanding, is that the receptive principle is the basis of the will.
Okay, but then I'm going to stop you, like, and not to, because like, we're talking ideas, and then there's like, you know, how it is on the ground. I mean, so, but one of the things I noticed when I was young was, you know, that witch and bitch were very closely the same word. And then also, I was never going to be the Pope. I was never going to be a priest. I wasn't going to be a rabbi. And that, you know, because I was female, there was like, there was something that no matter how smart I was, no matter how proficient, no matter how whatever, I wasn't going to rise above what I, you know, I was going to be, held down. So I don't, can you put those two things together and explain that to me?
When women talk about, I'm sure some feminists probably wouldn't. I mean, they don't want to hear a male talking about feminism.
Can I also jump in here and tell you that as a woman, I have never understood what the term feminism even means. I really don't get it. I feel ignorant. But go on.
I don't understand why every time, you know, someone talks about female empowerment, it's always the women imitating what the males are doing, and somehow that's empowerment. And I can see the value of that, don't get me wrong, on a certain level, because of what we're existing within. Yet, ultimately, it's not that women need to act like males, it's that men need to let in the essence of what a female actually is, and not just what we're projecting onto her.
Yeah, thank you, David.
And that was perfect, David. And I'm sorry, Alan, you go.
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't know how to explain it besides, like, I want to say vision, but not like, so it was like, I had this weird visualization, and I saw it as, you know, I could develop it as an art thing or whatever, but it was just, you know, it was a sort of representation of a sort of cycle, like, again, it was like four seasons or four elements, and it was this rising, you know, hot rock, like a fiery lava rock, you know, kind of rising up of male, you know, very phallic imagery of kind of like rising up. It's strong, but it's brittle. It's fiery. It's ragey. It's passionate. It's all these things, and then this thing rising, a wind coming, a very, you know, gentle wind taking it through this feminine sort of cloud, breaking it into pieces. It becomes the seeds, a gentle rain coming across it, those seeds being planted, and this masculine thing rising back up and watching this sort of very strong, you know, essentially like a yin-yang type idea of something coming up and then it gets broken down into this receptive idea. And when I started to intellectualize it, you know, it was the idea of like, is that inherently sexist? The idea that a woman is there to be receptive and a man is there to, you know, is this powerful thing and the woman's there to be receptive? And when I really started to intellectualize it, I could see how slippery that language is or that imagery or like what you infer from that. You know, are women, are we missing something by having women be quote-unquote empowered, meaning masculine? And I think, David, you just cut to the heart of it, where I was kind of, in one respect, it was this beautiful image in my mind, and when I tried to intellectualize it, it got really sticky really fast, and I could see how it could be misinterpreted, or, you know, I was like, is that coming out of something in me, or whatever? But again, it's not to say that it's, you know, a woman's place and a man's place is the woman gets put down, the man gets raised up, or anything like that, or to say that we don't, that we of course want to learn from each other and incorporate things. This is why the world card is androgynous. This is why that final hey combines the masculine and feminine. This is the idea of the alchemical marriage. Of course you want to integrate with each other, but that there's something to be said for not losing the feminine in that, and probably just as equally important, not losing the masculine in trying to incorporate the feminine. It's not that we become this mud that is neither anything, but that we need to kind of understand these different polarities and incorporate them better. If that makes sense.
It's why in the yin and the yang you have two, a dot of each in both.
And also I think it's really important to make the distinction between what you're talking about, Alan, is masculine and feminine. And then there's also the conversation about men and women. That masculinity and femininity are equally available to both male-gendered and female-gendered people, but as Jennifer points out, the Pope, you know, being the Pope or being a rabbi is not available to men and women equally, and that is the state that we're in. And it's interesting, bringing it back to Mad Men, it might explain why the men keep going in circles, because pretty much the masculine has been, all of the good parts of the masculine have been fully explored by the time we get to 1959, while the women are really the future. Like, as we know, we're moving into a future in which that feminine spirit is going to filter into both sexes. And so the women in Mad Men are the ones who are seeking out new territories, gaining new realizations, whereas the Mad Men are just running in this hollow circle that's been carved out for them by previous generations of patriarchs.
Yeah. That one guy loses his whole career because of interaction with homosexuality. Remember that?
Yeah.
The guy approaches him and then he, like, it's, you know.
Yeah. No, wait. What's funny about that? People miss that character. We want him to come back, and I forget his name, but he was awesome.
I know. I'm laughing because
his name was Sal.
Yeah, and no, it's one of the most tragic things that happens in the show, and it's communicating something, you know. My approach to things is I'll laugh at all kinds of terrible things.
We're doing dark humor, perfect, exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's a form of processing, I guess, for me. I hope people get that. When I laugh, I'm not laughing, you know, like an ape throwing shit on creatures from a tree or something. It's more like a anxiety-ridden processing of information.
Drown my sorrow. no tomorrow. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Mad world. Children waiting for the day they feel good. Happy birthday, happy birthday. And to feel the way that every child should. Sit and listen, sit and listen. Went to school and I was very nervous. Tell me what's my lesson. Look right through me, look right through me. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. People run in circles, it's a very, very mad.